from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. At the United Nations this morning, President Barack Obama called on world leaders to join forces against the rise of the militant group known as the Islamic State, which he called a network of death. And yesterday, President Obama applauded the U.S.-led airstrikes against that group, as well as aerial attacks expanded from Iraq into Syria. The United States also was aiming for another militant group known as Khorasan, which officials say was plotting attacks against Americans. What is Khorasan, and what will the attacks mean for U.S. foreign policy in the region and effectiveness against ISIS? Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning, and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This morning, earlier, President Obama addressed the United Nations, and he emphasized the need for unity in the light of the fight against the so-called Islamic State.
In this effort, we do not act alone, nor do we intend to send U.S. troops to occupy foreign lands. Instead, we will support Iraqis and Syrians fighting to reclaim their communities.
And yesterday, the United States and five Arab allies struck 29 targets in northern Syria against the Islamic State stronghold and the Khorasan terror group with some 48 airplanes and over 200 strikes. The barrage of bombs and missiles are aimed at crippling ISIS, which has claimed itself a caliphate and brutally executed Western journalists, as well as killing and massacring thousands of non-Sunni Muslims and men, women, and children of other faiths. Khorasan, a terrorist group characterized as an imminent threat to the West, was also hit by aerial attacks. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we want to sort out what all of this recent military activity means and what is likely to occur next in the ongoing commitment to destroy ISIS. We have a whole panel joining us, but first we want to go to Beirut and welcome Erica Solomon, who is a Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times, and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. And let me just get an update from you, if we can, from what you know in terms of today's activity, Erica Solomon. And I should mention that yesterday we're talking about some pretty serious damage in terms of destroying militant training groups and camps, weapons, fuel depots, those seized banks. There's been a lot of hits in this. Where are we today? Just moving forward with that? Or what do we know?
In Syria, there were not as many overnight strikes. The strikes seem to be mostly happening overnight. There was a dramatic sort of scale of attacks the first day that the United States-led coalition began their strikes. Today, we saw a much smaller number, and some of them aren't even confirmed. The United States has said that they focused on some parts of eastern Syria around the province of Deir Zor, a town called Al Bukamer. But on the ground, we're hearing a lot of reports from Syrian Kurdish militants in northwestern Syria that areas where they're under attack have also been struck by non-Syrian warplanes, but there's no confirmation from the foreign government on that. As far as the effect, they're actually, in terms of ISIS's actions, we haven't seen much of a change. That the focus for this group has been this attack in northwestern Syria, where it still seems to be advancing. So we're not seeing any change right now in terms of the group's military actions.
Are you seeing reaction from particularly Arab communities or, for that matter, within Syria to, as much as we know, or Iraq in terms of invading a sovereign state, which is the way some look at it, or getting help from Arab allies, which is certainly the way the United States wants to present it?
Overall, the reaction on the ground from the opposition side has been negative towards the coalition strikes. The U.S. decision to go after the so-called Islamic State targets, which U.S. officials have been calling the Khorasan group, but which to Syrians on the ground is known as the Nusra Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda-linked group, but is actually generally tolerated in opposition areas because they see it as a group that's been helping them fight Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, and the government that they've been struggling for 3 years to try and topple. So that has been, to them, a sign that maybe any group could become a target. So far, even groups that actually are aligned with the United States, in particular one called the Hazem Movement, which has actually been directly given U.S. aid, has started distancing itself publicly from the coalition strikes. So on the ground, from the opposition side, it's been pretty negative, the reaction. Interestingly, the government side has been pretty positive. President Obama has tried to go to great lengths to stress that there is no link between this action against Islamic State militants and support for the Assad regime. But what the mood on the ground is definitely quite the opposite. People feel like it's helping the Assad regime, and the Assad regime is actively working to make that perception grow.
Yeah, but you're in Lebanon, and Hezbollah is in support of the Assad regime. I know there's been concern with the Nusra Front and Lebanese in general about, in the wake of this conflict, perhaps it bleeding into there. But Hezbollah has had great enmity, of course, against Israel and against those it seems to believe are its foes. At this point, does it seem to be still siding with Assad and still to be opposed to ISIS?
Hezbollah is still fighting every day with President Bashar al-Assad's forces in parts of Syria where it sees a strategic need to be present, usually in terms of protecting its own areas in Lebanon. They have publicly come out against the American strikes, as basically everyone has. But the message, the sort of PR message that pro-Assad regime groups, which would include Hezbollah, are trying to get out is that, you know, this is sort of done in kind of not secret, but understood, behind-the-scenes understanding between the Assad regime and the U.S. government, similar to what we saw in Iraq, where it was very clear that whether there were direct communications happening, Iran and the United States were on the same page in terms of fighting the Islamic State militants. And Iran, of course, is the main backer of Hezbollah. So it's sort of a continuation now in terms of perception of what's going on in Syria. Whether that or not that's the case, we still don't know. As I said, the United States has been trying to stress it is not the case. They have no interest in working with the Assad regime. But again, I'm talking about the perception on the ground, and definitely that is what the regime wants to encourage people to think.
Erica Solomon, reporting from the Middle East. She's Middle East correspondent with the Financial Times and is in Beirut. Appreciative of your being with us. Thank you so much.
No worries.
Now let me introduce the panel that we have assembled for you this hour to continue talking about the airstrikes which began on ISIS, refugees fleeing, by the way, thousands of them going into Turkey. And this is mainly at this point an aerial war, but let me tell you who is with us to talk about it and to do some analysis here. Stephen Simon is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute. That's a nonprofit think tank based in the nation's capital. He's also visiting scholar at Dartmouth College and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America. Joins us from the studios at Dartmouth College. Welcome, Stephen Simon.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And we also have Jeffrey Whiteback with us on Forum, defense fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and his work there included planning for the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Jeffrey White, welcome.
Thank you.
Also want to welcome Fred Lawson here in studio with us, professor of government and the government department head at Mills College, author of Global Security Watch, Syria. Welcome, Fred Lawson.
Good morning, Mark.
Good to have you back with us. Let me begin, Stephen Simon, with you. There's certainly a lot of question about that I'd like to get some clarity on for our listeners about Khorasan. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it right. I think one of your colleagues said that the name was just invented kind of on the fly. But this plot that's been discovered over the past couple of weeks that led to their being hit. At this point, there's a lot of talk about what they were planning to do against the United States, that they were recruiting Westerners, that they were an imminent threat, all kinds of intelligence along those lines. What do we know about them?
Well, they appear to be situated within the Jabhat al-Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Khorasan is kind of an interesting word, actually, because it signifies the provinces to the east where the Islamic Messiah is to come at the end of days. So it has a kind of apocalyptic tinge to it that I think quite appeals to some of the jihadists. Apocalypticism tends to be a stream within their overall rhetoric. So choosing the name Khorasan is is fascinating in a way and indicative of their very, I would say, maximal or extremist goals. What we know about them from what essentially the U.S. government has been saying is that they are intent on attacking the United States or Western Europe. It did look as though they had a plot that was fairly advanced, which is what got them onto the target list for this last round of strikes within Syria. Again, according to what the U.S. government has said, have an aptitude for an interest in airplane attacks, that is, putting bombs on airplanes, which is a signature of another al-Qaeda group in the region, the one based in Yemen.
This is what we've identified with Ibrahim al-Assiri, the Yemen bomb maker. And also there's been talk about toothpaste, about explosive clothes, about shooting with shoulder-to-air missiles. I mean, we're getting a lot of different reports about how dangerous this group was or what it was planning.
Well, there are a lot of ways to bring down an airplane, and al-Qaeda has experimented at a minimum with a lot of these, whether, underwear or, shoe bombs liquid explosives brought onto airplanes, implanting explosives into printer cartridges and putting those on airplanes. And they have used shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles to attack airplanes in Africa. And in fact, not all that many years ago, but some time ago, a large cache of these weapons was found in Saudi Arabia, and captured by the Saudi government from jihadists there when they were in full swing in the 2003-2004 timeframe. So if there's a way to bring down an airplane, the jihadists have thought of it.
Well, we were also having reports that this particular jihadist movement, its leader, Mushin al-Fadli, was killed in the aerial attacks. I don't know if we have that confirmed yet, but that's initially what was reported.
Yeah, that has been reported. The administration was initially coy about this when they were asked about it right after the strike, saying that a judgment on this matter would have to wait until the bomb damage assessment had been completed by the Pentagon. But apparently they're saying now that Fazli was killed.
These groups are kind of hard to sort through. I mean, these are mostly Salafi groups and Sunni jihadists. But al-Nusra, for example, and I wanted to just get your reading on this, Stephen Simon, is supposedly at odds now with ISIS.
Yes. The two groups have broken. In other words, ISIS did not want to pledge allegiance, so to speak, to the head of al-Qaeda. They march to the beat of a different drum. They, first of all, don't subscribe to the win hearts and minds of fellow Muslims ethos of the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria. They take a much more a much tougher line towards fellow Muslims that don't toe the line. And I'm talking about fellow Sunnis, let alone Shiites or other apostates from their point of view.
So forgive me, this is the same break we saw in Iraq with al-Zarqawi and al-Qaeda, yes?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a very shrewd observation, actually, because there's a real similarity between these guys in ISIS and Zarqawi, who was killed, as you recall, by the U.S. In Iraq. But of course, they're in the same lineage organizationally as well as ideologically. The other thing is that ISIS seems to be focused on what bin Laden used to call the near enemy. They want to fight the people. I'm talking about ISIS now. They want to fight the people right around them, and they want to take territory, and they want to begin to create what is, in their view, a proper Islamic State or a caliphate. Al-Qaeda was focused on the far enemy. That is to say, the foreign powers like the United States, for example, who were seen as propping up the near enemy. From their perspective, that strategy made a lot of sense. So they fashion themselves into the kind of terrorist group that would be capable of attacking great powers like the United States. That seems to be a very different focus from that of ISIS at this point.
Again, Stephen Simon with us from the studios of Dartmouth College, a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute, and Jeffrey White's a defense fellow with the Washington Institute. And when we're talking about this kind of strategy that ISIS has had, I think it's called the ink spot strategy, build the caliphate and just take land and more land, Jeffrey Wright. How much can that realistically be stopped, particularly when you have a lot of Sunni support? In fact, this coalition has some members who were giving a good deal of support to Salafism and what ISIS seems to stand for, and probably monetary and other kinds of support to ISIS. But I'm just talking about doing it by air as opposed to, you know, getting boots on the ground like Martin Dempsey and others have said we may have to do.
Well, I think you can slow them, you can disrupt them, you can damage some of their capabilities by air power. And I think we've seen that already to some extent in Iraq. And you can support ground offensives by ground forces if you have them available. But air power alone isn't going to make ISIS go away. I don't think anyone serious is arguing that is the case, that there does need to be a ground forces and all. But we can definitely punish them and make it more difficult for them to operate, make it more difficult for them to conduct offensive operations, make it more difficult for them to command and control their forces, disrupt their logistics, and eventually perhaps even attack their oil income producing elements inside Syria. So a lot can be done with air power, but not everything.
Well, when President Obama says no boots on the ground, no forces going in there, isn't he essentially maybe doing what he did with Syria initially, saying there's a red line here and I'm not going to cross it, and sort of telegraphing what he's going to hold himself responsible for that the enemy can benefit from?
Well, I think what he's said more is that instead of boots on the ground, it's no boots on the ground in combat. We already have people on the ground in Iraq that are involved in supporting combat operations by various Iraqi forces and in supporting U.S. air operations. So this idea that there's a real strong or clear dividing line between what our troops are doing now in actual combat, I think, is getting pretty blurred. And I think what we will see over time is that the use of U.S. troops in Iraq is going to be adaptive. That is, that the president and the U.S. military commanders will respond to the situation, and they'll be used as necessary. That doesn't mean we're going to deploy an armored division or a mechanized division or very large numbers of combat troops in there to operate. But I think this distinction between fighting and advising or assisting in some way is going to get blurred over time.
Well, how much efficacy do you contribute to, let's say, just on the ground, an army that amounts to roughly 15,000? I mean, with that kind of troop, and I'm talking about ISIS now, with that kind of, those kind of troop numbers, it would seem inevitably unlikely for them to take Baghdad or to invade Turkey or Saudi Arabia or, any Iran, Kuwait, anybody around in the territory, Jordan, Israel, for that matter.
Yeah, I think that's right. The numbers we're now hearing are maybe 31,000 total ISIS fighters, whatever. Those numbers are, kind of suspect and, basically a lot of uncertainty about the numbers. But they don't have a huge army, and it's not an army that's equipped with, large amounts of heavy weapons. They have some tanks, some artillery, and so on. But this is, in a lot of ways,
they've got a lot of our weapons.
Right. But they like, we've never actually seen an M1 tank that they captured in combat. They have integrated some of our artillery. They've integrated a lot of our Humvees and so on. But it's not an army in the sense that it has very significant, heavily equipped ground combat forces. ISIS usually succeeds against weakness. That is, where they find forces that they can overwhelm by surprise, that they can undermine, subvert, and so on, or simply mass and get enough people and weapons in the area and overrun them. When it runs into well-organized, coherent forces and so on, it has a much more difficult time. And we haven't really seen ISIS do much advancing in Iraq since resistance has stiffened and since the U.S. air campaign has begun.
Yeah, but you just have to wonder, with taking Mosul and Fallujah like they did, there was a great deal of support from the Sunni population, or so it would appear.
Sure, that's the pretty incompetent and ineffective, or worse than ineffective, Iraqi government contributed to a situation where ISIS could draw local support, from tribal elements, from former Baathists, and so on. And the Iraqi army was regarded as the enemy in many of these areas, and it really it facilitated their advances.
It certainly did. I'm sorry, I want to bring Fred Lawson into this, because we have to consider Syria in this. And we've been talking, Fred, about how illegitimate the Assad government is, and now we're aiding them by, I suppose, most standards, aren't we?
There's certainly going to be an indirect aid, perhaps an unintended aid, to the authorities in Damascus. And the reports are that before the first bombings took place, Secretary Kerry sent some sort of message to the authorities in Damascus through the Iraqi government announcing that the attacks would take place. And as the reporter in Beirut pointed out, the Syrian authorities immediately jumped on this as showing that the United States respected Syria, was willing to work together with Syria, and the Syrian authorities have welcomed the attacks and have claimed that the bombings do not constitute a breach of Syrian sovereignty because of that advance warning.
What about the coalition that the president's formed? I mean, this morning he was talking as if he was almost saying, can him please join us? It was an invitation. I'm surprised, for example, you've got Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Bahrain. But where's Egypt, for example?
Well, it's an important coalition, and it's an important coalition not only because the Saudis and the Qataris in the past have sent support to some of the Islamist movements inside Syria, but it's an important coalition because it does give local military establishments on the ground practice working together with American forces. The Egyptians have their hands full with an Islamist insurgency along the Sinai border, with a group fighting the Egyptian authorities that is in some ways in league with the Islamic State and with the militants in other parts of the region. The Iraqis have their hands full as well. What's missing from the coalition is certainly Turkey, is certainly Jordan, and is Iran. One would think that in order to have a truly successful regional operation, Jordan in particular and Turkey should be active partners in military operations. Both of those governments are keeping their arms linked.
I also have to wonder what was traded, perhaps even arms, for those 49 hostages who were released from being held by ISIS to Turkey. And we're going to be training and equipping Syrian rebels, but we don't necessarily know who these Syrian rebels are. I mean, a lot of them could be devout jihadis, right?
The main place where the training's taking place is in Jordan, and that is the one place where the Free Syrian Army does seem to have some presence.
Let me give out the phone number and invite listeners to join the program. We're talking about the airstrikes, which began yesterday against ISIS and Khorasan, and you can join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. Khorasan. It's 866-733-6786, and we welcome your phone calls. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments there. And the website is kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment. And, of course, you can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Please join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Those who have joined ISIL should leave the battlefield while they can. Those who continue to fight for a hateful cause will find they are increasingly alone. For we will not succumb to threats, and we will demonstrate that the future belongs to those who build, not those who destroy.
That was President Obama speaking earlier today at the United Nations, and this all congeals with the airstrikes yesterday against ISIS, and that's what we're talking about here. aerial attacks that expanded from Iraq into Syria. Fred Lawson's here with us in studio, professor of government and the government department head at Mills College. He's author of Global Security Watch, Syria. Stephen Simon is with us by phone, and he's senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, which is a nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. He's also visiting scholar at Dartmouth and is with us from the studios at Dartmouth College and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America. We also have Jeffrey White on the line from the nation's capital, who is a defense fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and who spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency, including the planning for the 2003 invasion. And we should mention that there was another beheading in Algeria, and this was a story really right off the wires here. The French, of course, have said that they would give aerial support, and there seems to be a connection between that, just to keep you up to date here. And I was talking a little bit off air with Fred Lawson about, I want to go to your calls and emails here, but about the role of the Soviets in this. I mean, they have always been very close to Syria and really a patron of Syria. And, of course, they have their own Islamic jihadi uprising going on in Chechnya, but they're always kind of involved in these things in some way. So what do you see?
Well, I think the Russian position is changing in subtle but important ways. The Russian position...
I did say Soviet. I mean Russian. That was a strange pathological slip on my part.
I do it all the time.
Yeah.
The Russians were strong supporters of state sovereignty, of non-intervention, were critical of any efforts by outside powers to intervene in local politics. But over the last few days, the Russians have sent signals that perhaps the Islamic State, perhaps other organizations, are worth crushing before they can spread to other countries. Russia faces problems of its own with an Islamist insurgency in Chechnya and increasingly in Dagestan. And many of the fighters that have joined the Assistance Front or have joined the Islamic State have come from the former Soviet republics. And so the Russians are increasingly seeing this as a chance to be able to stop a spreading Islamist movement before it blows back inside Russia.
Jeffrey White, just a quick question for you, and that is the president keeps talking about degrading and destroying ISIS. This is a long haul. There's no way around that, is there?
No, I think it's going to take some time to do it. A lot, of course, depends upon the level of effort that the United States and its allies put into it. If we want to mount a very major air campaign and get lots of help from our allies, not only Arabs, but say the UK and France operating in Syria, then we might be able to make it go quicker. But to root them out, to really damage their capabilities, to degrade them to the point where they're more of a nuisance than a real threat, yeah, that is going to take some time.
And Stephen Simon, could I just get your thoughts quickly, because I want to get to our callers and emailers, but just all these calls, particularly from some of the more extremists for lone wolves and all infidels to be shot or knifed or killed in some fashion. I mean, this is certainly a threat not only to the homeland but throughout Europe, and we've been hearing enough about Europeans and Americans being trained in Syria.
Yeah, I think that we can expect them to try to reach out and touch someone. There's no question about that. Right now, it looks as though most of the people who are stirred by the rhetoric of this group are actually going to Syria to fight there, to help establish and consolidate the caliphate. They're not actually carrying out attacks in their hometowns, although, of course, there are reports of conspiracies on the part of lone wolves to do exactly that. But they don't appear to have been directed to do so in any fashion by ISIS or its leadership or what have you. They're just enterprising individuals. And this is something that we've seen for a long time, certainly since 9/11. The rhetoric about killing Americans and all that has been with us for quite a while. Bin Laden's son-in-law, who was the spokesman for al-Qaeda and who incidentally has just been sentenced to life in prison in the United States, Suleiman Abu Ghaith, said that, there should be X number of Americans killed for every Muslim who was killed, either by the United States or, in a way that's instigated by the United States. So that's been around for a while. I think it would be unreasonable for us to expect to emerge unscathed, especially now that we have declared war in such a bold a fashion.
Well, forgive me. Have we really declared war? We haven't congressionally declared war here. I mean, there is a war going on, but you hear John Kerry, the Secretary of State, talking, and it's almost like he wants to avoid using that three-letter word.
Yeah, he does. But, I mean, the other side, in this isn't all that concerned about constitutional requirements for advice and consent of the Senate. They've got bombs dropping on them, so they probably consider themselves to be in a state of war with the United States, which is perfectly fine with them, I think. One thing we have to bear in mind as we consider the threat flowing from ISIS is the fact that we have put billions of dollars into our homeland security infrastructure and our capacities for ensuring the integrity of our borders and so forth. We've created a Homeland Security department from scratch. We said it would take 10 years for it really to come together. Well, it's been 10 years now, and it has more or less come together. And we're, I think, in a much better position than we were certainly before 9/11. So I think even though it would be foolish to think that the other guy can't get under the wire and snap one off here in the United States, it's going to be fairly difficult.
Let me bring in our callers. We go first, RCL, to you. Good morning. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. So my question is for the guests. So I know the administration was talking about having a coalition with other Middle Eastern countries. And at the beginning of this whole issue, the Obama administration was talking about bringing in Iran. And I was wondering whatever happened with that, because I know Iran is isolationist even by Middle Eastern standards. So that's my question.
Well, it's a good question. In fact, I'm looking at an online comment from one of our listeners. Shauna says, it's my opinion that we should be working with Iran and Syria in our fight against ISIS rather than just giving them the cold shoulder. Want to opine on this, Fred Lawson?
There are different reports about this. One report is that Secretary of State Kerry did quietly, under the table, send an overture to Iran whether Iran might possibly participate in some sort of move, and the supreme leader in Iran flatly rejected the offer. Probably the Iranians want to be invited publicly. They want to be brought into the international community.
They also want us to back off on the negotiations where nuclear power is concerned, too.
And very much that as well.
Let me thank the caller for that. But what about working with Syria? I mean, this is, again, a government or an administration, I should say, that has pretty much presented it in opposition to Assad. So we're between a rock and a hard place there. Syria would be perhaps the best ally just from a military standpoint.
Probably so, except that the Turkish government has firmly committed itself to overthrowing the Assad regime. And if the United States makes any overtures at all to Damascus, it will lose whatever credibility, lose whatever support it might have in the future in Turkey.
Bring in another of your calls. We'll go next to Jay. Good morning. Jay, you're on.
Good morning. My question is, I know that we have a coalition built up with the support of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, and some other United Arab Emirates or some other Middle East countries. And I know quite a few of these countries are predominantly Sunni rulers ruling a majority Shia population. And now this ISIS is being supported by some of these Sunnis in Iraq. And also, I wanted to know, what is the sect to which most of these Islamic fighters belong to, other than the foreign fighters that have come in there? And what is the impact of this whole thing in terms of the Shia people of the Middle Eastern countries who were trying to bring about a revolution and freedom sometime late last year, and that was suppressed by Bahrain and Saudi and other countries?
Well, lots of questions there, but let me get Stephen Simon to opine on this. I mean, this is an ongoing, because of ISIS, a terrible and violent division between Sunni and Shia Muslims.
Yes, it certainly is. The Saudis in particular have found themselves in an interesting position where, they were involved in the Syrian civil war really rather deeply as suppliers of as a supplier of money and arms to the armed opposition. and their focus was on getting rid of Assad. On the other hand, they're looking at an ideological and military threat really from their right. And that's exactly what ISIS is. I mean,
Stephen, it's also a group that claims that they are the caliphate, which must be enraging to the House of Saud to hear them make that claim.
Well, I'm sure it's disconcerting. The Al Saud have themselves not claimed to have inherited the caliphate, which was put out of its misery in 1923 in the wake of World War I. What I think is interesting here is that the Saudis have decided that they need to focus on the threat from the right, and which is to say radical Sunni militancy, and postpone for later getting rid of Assad. This may be a case of, business before pleasure, but they've got to
do that. Is that diluting the kind of Wahhabism that really led to 9/11? Do you think, in Saudi Arabia? Because that was pretty militant Wahhabism, Salafism.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that the Saudis will be concerned about is the infectious nature of ISIS-type Wahhabism and the ability of that group, in a sense, osmotically, gain adherence within Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudis faced an uprising in the early 2000s after 2001 that was really rather bloody. They suppressed it. It took a couple of years. And in the wake of the uprising, they instituted a range of counter-radicalization programs, some of which were quite inventive, creative. But they could re-experience that problem, and I think that's not something they want to undergo once again. So they're going to help the United States and help themselves by going after ISIS and then postpone the battle against, other forms of apostasy, especially in the shape of Assad later on.
Yeah, Fred Lawson wanted a word in here. Yeah.
And I think the protests in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia are still going on. They've been suppressed a little bit, but the Shi'i community is still explosive in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. And the caller is right to point out that this conflict in Syria is polarizing the region along sectarian lines and might well encourage Shi'i activists in a variety of countries.
But look what's happened in Yemen. And he mentioned Bahrain, and, it's really pervasive. Let me get another caller on, and that's you, Ram. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, the current campaign against ISIS is having the impact of strengthening Iran's hand. Like you pointed out, in Yemen, Houthis are gaining the upper hand. Hezbollah and Syria will undoubtedly benefit from these airstrikes. ISIL was the only counterweight against Iran, and now ISIL is being targeted. So Iran, at the end of the day, will come out stronger. How is U.S. going to deal with that? Or is U.S. okay with that position?
Yeah, Jeffrey White, how do you see that?
Well, I don't necessarily see Iran coming out of this, ahead out of the campaign against ISIL, ahead in some way. The Iranians are trying to defend their interests in Iraq. They are actively involved. If they're not explicitly operating in coordination with the United States, they certainly are, working with the Iraqi government forces and so on, to push ISIL back. I think in Syria, my view is that the regime gain something from the airstrikes, but it doesn't gain a great deal. And by striking the ISIL in Syria, we're also in some ways helping the moderate opposition there. So it's not so simple to say that strikes in Syria are going to benefit the regime. One thing I'd like to point out, though, is that the regime is no bargain in terms of participating, with the U.S. In any kind of campaign against ISIL. In addition to its, terrible record of atrocities and the way it's fought the war there, it doesn't actually bring a lot to the table in terms of military capabilities against ISIL. It has some capability to bomb them, but ISIL has actually defeated Syrian forces on the ground, and the regime isn't very good at taking the offensive on the ground. So, you know, any notion that, you know, getting the Syrians on our side to fight ISIL, I think it's, you know, a pretty deeply flawed notion.
Let me read some comments from listeners. One listener writes, the whole situation is ridiculous. The U.S. complacently sold weapons to Turkey, knowing full well they were arming the rebels in Syria. Now they broke off to form ISIL with the U.S. weapons in hand. This reminds me of why we're strip searched by X-rays at airports now, because the U.S. armed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to drive out the Soviets, despite the military pact between the Afghan government and the Soviets. How many freedoms did the U.S. citizens lose because the U.S. didn't want the Soviets to mine copper and gold and armed the groups that later became those that pulled off 9/11 and now are involved with Syrian rebels? Our leaders are collectively insane and never learn. They keep repeating the same mistakes, and the citizens are the ones who will ultimately pay. Bill writes, so is the Khorasan group this new war's equivalent of weapons of mass destruction? Call me a cynic and a skeptic, but it seems all too convenient that this new threat suddenly bubbled up yesterday just as we started bombing. One has to wonder if it's simply the cover story to sell on the necessity of breaking more pottery in the Middle East. And Robert sends this email. I'm concerned about the message that we're sending by leading an allied effort with allies who are largely repressive regimes. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain, the UAE. Are the leaders of those countries really the people that we want to be associated with, given how they treat their own people and the complete lack of democracy? Another listener comment. Will the bombings only create another offshoot of ISIS or al-Qaeda that will adapt and evolve like a virus? Have we learned nothing from other viral contagions? And here's David, who says, in Iraq, we learned that it is not enough to obtain military victory. We must be able to follow us by helping foreign countries develop their governments to effectively hold and maintain territory. The U.S. should focus more effort on creating expertise to help develop civil societies after military victories. We need off-the-shelf models for creating effective civil governments that can provide the necessities of civil societies to maintain political and military stabilities. Fred Lawson, there's a good deal of wisdom in that. I mean, we've been talking a lot about military and so forth, but governance ought to be in tandem with this, and governance and essentially what kind of governance is really a key to anything being succeeded in here.
That last remark seems very much on target to me. The Syrian civil war has now been going on for 4 bloody years. There's a leadership of the opposition that's largely based outside the country that the United States has been working with all that time. But yet the leadership outside the country still has no real connections with fighters on the ground. It doesn't have a coherent military structure. The United States has no armed forces to supply advisors or supply weaponry to. One would think that over the last 4 years, some effort would have been made to build an infrastructure, to build an administrative apparatus that perhaps would give the opposition some kind of local roots, some kind of ability to challenge these militant Islamist organizations. But instead, there's been a vacuum that the Islamists have moved into.
And again, Fred Lawson heads the Department of Government and is professor of government at Mills College, author of Global Security Watch Syria. That same listener, David, adds, ISIS, the Muslim Brotherhood, and like organizations have obtained support by helping populations meet basic needs, including housing, food, and electricity. The West needs to beat terrorist organizations at providing people with basic needs in order to win hearts and minds of people everywhere. Fred?
And even though I think it's unfair to say that there was Sunni support for the Islamic State, nevertheless, the Free Syrian Army groups that first moved into central Syria, into Raqqa, and pushed the authorities out, exhibited the kind of corruption and confiscated property in a way that alienated the local population. And the local population did at first welcome the Assistance Front and the Islamic State in, because those people at first did seem to have some principles, did seem to have some moral background to their programs that then spun off in a radical direction.
Well, speaking of principles, and let me go to you on this, Stephen Simon. I've got a tweet here from a listener named Debbie who says, can you talk about al-Qaeda and ISIS's ideologies? Al-Qaeda, principle nihilism, and ISIS just nihilism, and their appeal to European-born Pakistanis and others.
I wouldn't call them nihilists, really, because they do believe in something that for them constitutes a positive program. They're seeking to return their societies to a pattern of behavior and belief and order that was ideal in many respects. I mean, in their conception of it, it might never have existed in reality, but nevertheless, they believe it really did. And it was a form of society that guaranteed justice for all believers, fair treatment, and salvation.
So, and Sharia.
Yes. Well, you know, the Sharia is a code of behavior. You know, it's a rule book. It's interpreted variously. But, of course, they would say that the Sharia, as they define it, would be the code that would regulate life in this community.
Let me go to a military question for you, if I may, Jeffrey White, from a listener who writes, how can there be airstrikes without troops on the ground? Aren't there assets available to rescue downed pilots? Who is calling in the strikes, and aren't combat air controllers involved, or is this all being done by technology?
Well, in Iraq, there are people on the ground that have at least some level of training in controlling the strikes and so on, not necessarily U.S., so that we have some capability there to provide that kind of support. But by and large, this is being done by various technical means, U.S. satellite collection systems, drone collection systems, signals intelligence, and so on. And in Syria, that appears to be the only way it's being done. That is, we're using the massive intelligence capabilities that we've developed over time to locate these targets, and then to strike them precisely. So it's basically a technical collection matter.
Yeah, I've been getting a couple of emails, though, that express concern about the fact that the United States maybe is funding and arming ISIS indirectly by funding the rebels in Syria. I mean, I'm looking at a Facebook comment here from a listener who says, ISIS knows how to play the game, and we're going to be left not only looking foolish, but being hit by another terrorist attack.
Well, nothing that we've provided in the way of military assistance to rebels in Syria has, in fact, found its way, you know, basically to ISIS. The weapon.
How do we know that?
Because we just don't see them, with those kinds of weapons. The stuff they have captured, the U.S. type of weapon we see in their possession, is stuff they basically took in their offensive in Iraq. So the kind of aid we're providing to the Syrian rebels, especially like the TOW anti-tank guided missiles, you know, they aren't moving around. They're pretty much, or as far as I know, totally sticking with the groups that we've provided to. But when you provide weapons into an environment like Syria, there's no absolute 100% guarantee that they won't eventually find their way into the hands of some other group. So in a sense, you have to accept some level of risk here anytime you're providing military aid to irregular forces, especially when we don't have our own people on the ground there to watch them and to maintain really close personal track of them.
Here's another caller. Yang, you're on. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a comment about this concept of moderate rebels. And I've been following this issue on TQED for a while, and when the concept of moderate rebels was often brought up, it was often referring to the Syrian army. But I actually listened to you guys describe an incident about a few weeks ago where the Free Syrian Army actually beheaded about 10 people from an opposing faction. So I think overall this concept of moderate rebels is really naive. It's really hard to define who is more evil over there. Just picking out a so-called moderate rebel is just as naive as us supporting Bin Laden back in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and finding out later that they bite us so badly.
Yeah, we certainly keep hearing that analogy in the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But Fred Lawson, moderate rebels seems to this listener and to many to be maybe even oxymoronic.
There may possibly have been some moderate militias in 2011, 2012, But they've very much been pushed off the battlefield. They've been eclipsed. They've given up hope. Some of the troops that joined the moderate militias discovered that they were not getting ammunition, not getting any support, whereas the militant Islamists were. So the personnel drifted into the more radical formations. I think the caller's right. There's really no moderate opposition out there.
Looking at an email from a listener who writes, ISIS made the U.S. trained and supported team in Baghdad look cowardly, and President Obama is now merely trying to save face and protect the status quo. President Obama's efforts will merely drive this group into the shadows and make them a more threatening group against the United States. We are once again fighting someone else's war. And again, CNN and others have managed to break news that an ISIS-affiliated group in Algeria has beheaded a French national. We wonder what effects this will have. But at this point, we're getting news that just keeps to providing us with different ways of looking at this and ways of trying to understand it. And I want to thank all the guests who were with us this hour who really provided a good deal of light and illumination. Stephen Simon, senior fellow with the Middle East Institute and the author, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America. Thank you, Stephen Simon. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jeffrey White, defense fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, who spent 34 years at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Good to have you with us, Jeffrey White.
Hey, thank you.
And thanks to Fred Lawson, professor of government and the government department head at Mills College, author of Global Security Watch, Syria. Thank you,
Appreciate
Fred.
Your program, Michael.
Thank you, and thanks to Erica Solomon, who joined us earlier. Eric Solomon's a friend of mine. Erica Solomon, the Middle East correspondent we had with us from the Financial Times, who joined us from Beirut. We're going to be joined in the next hour by Tavis Smiley, well-known public radio host and host not only in television but in radio, who has a book out on the last year of Martin Luther King. Thank you for being a part of the program. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.